This is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane on the 14th of September, 1978. And we'll pick up this tape, about 1954. Okay.
Well, my job at ALP was in this logistics planning field, and it was very, very interesting for me because it was an experience that I had not had before, working very, very closely with logisticians, and I really learned a hell of a lot. I've often said that in my whole career in the Air Force, those 2 years I spent in logistics plans, I learned more than anything else because it served me in such great stead later on when I became, for example, the Air Officer Commanding Transport Command, to be able to deal with engineers and supply people and the whole logistics field from a position of knowing what it was all about, as opposed to the average pilot who had shunned and hated the thought of ever getting involved with logistics. That you had other people to do and worry about those things.
Yeah.
But when you became a commander, you had to. So the time I had there was terribly interesting for me. So it was with a bit of, it was a real surprise, a pleasant surprise, but also a shock and with some regret that I was told, oh, it would be, I suppose, about October of 54, that I was going, being sent to the Imperial Defense College in London for the year 1955. And there, at that college, the year starts right after New Year's. So it meant packing up and moving sort of over the Christmas, New Year's period. And then having the whole year in London at IDC. It's now, the title has now been changed. It's no longer called the Imperial Defense College. It's called the College of Commonwealth Studies or some such name as that. They have changed it. They changed it for political reasons. And people are complaining about the word imperial.
Yeah. Empire.
Empire, yes. But so as a result, I said farewell to all that logistics work and took off for IDC.
Can I interrupt just for a minute, Reg? You say it came to you as a surprise. You didn't apply.
Mm-mm. No. We only sent two people to IDC every year, and they were selected by the Air Member for Personnel, and then the chief approved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I never know. I to this day do not know who actually selected me, whether it was AMP or whether it was the chief, because by that time, Roy Slemon was still the chief, and we had, of course, known each other very well during the war, and I had done a lot of work with Roy Slemon, so he may have been his suggestion. On the other hand, my boss at that time, the Air Member for Technical Services, was Johnny Plant, and of course, I have known Johnny for some time, and it may have been his suggestion. I still do not know who actually put me up to go to IDC. But it was quite a feather in one's cap to be selected for IDC. We did not have, I don't think our National Defense College was operating at that time. No, it was not. So there was, and we had just been cut off from attending the United States Air War College, which was the equivalent of the Imperial Defense College. And we were chopped off that course in Washington because France and a few others were complaining bitterly that they could not send people to it, and yet Canada could. Those states were putting them in an embarrassing position. They're saying, well, we'll have to have cut off any foreigner attending our Air War College, whereas Canada, Canadians were the only ones outside who were attending that course at that time. And I think Larry Dunlap was one who went to the Air War College, and there were a couple, which was, of course, equally as good as the Imperial Defense College in London. So to be selected to go to IDC really was a great feather in your cap, because it was something that was a real bonus. It was a year, which was recognized as being a year of a real sabbatical, but no pressure. The way they operated that course was fantastic, and I'll get into it in a minute. But the other thing that was that I was only 35, and to go to IDC at 35 was the other half of this, which really shook me rigid, because IDC is a course that normally comes in as one of the top course. After you had IDC, there was nowhere to go. So that here I was, with still roughly another 20 years service ahead of me, and I was taking the top course.
Mm-hmm.
And I would that would be it. But on the other hand, and I argued this when I came back, that we had been sending people at too late a stage in their career. And the net result was that when they came back, they would have just a short period of time to go before they retired. And I felt that the value of the course was perhaps being lost. And I saw that when the number of Brits on the course who retired within 3 and 4 years after completing IDC. And I thought, what a dreadful waste. It's a very expensive course. It would cost a lot of money to put on. The college itself is located in one of those old stately homes right behind Buckingham Palace in one of the squares. And a beautiful home, beautiful house, but cold as could be. There's no central heating. And the main lecture room was the original reception room or lounge or main hall of this mansion. And the heat came from literally what we would call the old pot-iron-bellied stove, which had been stuck into the open fireplace. And that was the heat for that great big room. And the number of times we sat there that winter, that first winter, and later on the following fall, late fall, early winter, with our coats on, I hate to tell you about it. And you couldn't, of course, the windows had to be closed because it was so cold. And damp, naturally. I mean, it was part of the dampness as much as anything else. But then there were a lot of people who smoked, and people were allowed to smoke during the lectures and what have you. And, of course, you could cut the air in the damn room with a knife. It really wasn't much fun. But then, of course, when the spring came, it was fine. Well, we arrived, we another thing that happened on that trip, after being told I was to go, the question of getting there, and with a little, I must admit, a little machination on the part of the movement's people with me, who I knew very well, they said, well, now, if you decided not to go before, I forget the date now, I think it was something like about the 15th of December, if you hold off until then, the only boat you can go on, because we weren't flying people over, and we had all kinds of stuff to take with us, naturally, for a year, the only boat you could go on would be the Queen Elizabeth out of New York. And if you'd like to go on the Queen Elizabeth, then just say you can't leave until about the 14th or 15th, and we'll have to put you on that boat. So I immediately said, done, because an opportunity to travel on the Queen Elizabeth first class was a chance not to be missed. And as it happened, after that trip, no one else ever traveled on the Queen's. The decision was made that nobody traveled on the Queen's. It was too damned expensive to travel first class.
Well, I imagine by this time, certainly the Queen would have been refurbished and redone.
Oh, no. Queen Elizabeth was a beautiful ship. Oh, beautiful ship. We went down, and I also took delivery of a brand-new Oldsmobile, a 55 Oldsmobile. As a matter of fact, it was one of them, but I had trouble getting it from the plant, because they wanted, I had to take delivery fairly early. I think it had to be 60 days before we left the country, something like that. And then I had to have it exported. I had to go to a customs entry port, export it, and then re-import it on a temporary license. You had to go right literally to the border to do this. You couldn't do the paperwork in an office in town. You had to drive the car to the border, export it and with the papers, and then get a re-entry permit to come back in, and then it had to be out of the country again within the 60 days or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So I took delivery of this brand new Oldsmobile, and I had trouble getting it because I wanted a 55. I didn't want a 54. And it was about the 50th car off the line, and the people at the plant, GM plant, and were asking me, they said, please don't drive around too much because you've got a car even before some of our our dealers have across the country. I said, don't worry about it. This car is not going to be driven very much, and we're leaving very soon anyway. So he said, okay. Well, we drove the car down to New York, and it went on board the ship, went on board the Kiwi. So with our stuff, and away we went. And we had a great trip. So it's a very, very pleasant way to travel, I can tell you. It was most enjoyable. The only thing wrong with it was that the Queen does the Atlantic trip too fast, it's over before you know where you are. And as soon as we hit the Gulf Stream, there it was, middle of December, hit the Gulf Stream, and people were out on the sun deck and the chairs, and it was just beautiful, smooth crossing, just lovely.
Beautiful.
Well, we arrived in England, and then my wife being English, we went up to spend Christmas with her parents up in Yorkshire, and we were in Leeds, driving in Leeds, stopped at a stoplight, and a great big lorry came along and took the side off the brand new Oldsmobile, which was a bit annoying. And there was really nothing we could do about it except take it back, get it down to London, where the Oldsmobile agents were, and then just put it in their shops and have them fix it. It was a silly thing, but it's the kind of thing that can happen, yeah. And there was nothing we could do about it. I could still drive the car, but it was just badly bent, yeah. And down the side, which was terrible. It just made my heart bleed. Here I had a brand new car, and anything when that happened. Well, then the course started. The commandant was an air chief marshal, and he opened up the first meeting, the first day, and he said, very simply, he said, "You now have all been awarded the symbol IDC. What you do from here on is entirely up to you. The mere fact that you are here has granted you the symbol of IDC. There will be no course reports, because the whole purpose of this course is built up on the people who attend it, and the course is as good as you people want to make it. And the directing staff, directing staff was very small, the directing staff have no, will not push, they will not criticize, and they will not comment. There will be no report. There's not even a personnel report prepared at the end of the course. So you are on your own from here on in, so good luck and enjoy the course." And it was good. It was good psychology, because everyone knew that all right, those who wanted to work would work, and we'd very soon find out those who didn't want to work. And we had them, and it's incredible how it worked. Very first exercise, or I should say the very first syndicate study that we had to complete was a one on economics. And it was at that time the UK was in pretty dire straits economically, and conversely Canada was booming. Booming. Well, I was nicked as a syndicate leader for the first exercise, which was again a bit of a shock, because here I was with all these people, and hell, I was a real youngster in the class. I suppose the average age of the other people would be in their late 40s. But anyway, I was a syndicate leader, and I was indeed very fortunate to have in my syndicate a chap who, from the British Treasury, who was on the course. And he was a real pro. He was one of those quiet, terribly clever Englishmen who could write so beautifully and with no effort. Everything seemed to be absolutely effortless. So I nicked him right away. I asked him if he would be the secretary, and he, our scribe, and he said yes, he would. He'd be delighted to do it. And then, of course, we were off and running. It was a question of mapping out how we would tackle the problem of the economy of Great Britain, and the whole idea was to try and forecast and look ahead and make recommendations and so forth. And I suppose the real object is it's one of those type of things where the leading up to the end of the course, and you had to cover all these fields and get some indication and feel for things so that you were in a better position when the end of the course came to write the final study, which really was what should Great Britain do about its defenses, and which was a three-month study. Well, he did a simply masterful job, and it was I should also add that one of the other great values of IDC, and I wish to hell our National Defense College would do the same thing, if there was a particularly good paper prepared by one of the syndicates, all the papers, of course, were read by the directing staff, including the commandant, the air chief marshal. And if there was a particularly good one, it was picked out and sent to the cabinet. Not to anyone else, it was sent right to the cabinet secretariat. And then the cabinet secretariat, if they thought it was worthwhile, they would either distribute it, send it to the PM, or whatever. In other words, mm-hmm. There was a very, very good channel. Well, as it happened, this particular paper was one that was selected and sent up the line. And this chap, this treasury boy, and the whole syndicate had a great joy about 2 months later when a white paper came out on the British economy, and seeing several paragraphs that literally had just been taken right out of the paper we had done and were verbatim put into the white paper. And of course this gave us a great flip, as you can imagine, and particularly this chap. But that was he was a brilliant chap. I've often wondered, obviously he did well, I have lost touch with him, but I'd love to know where he is right now. And there are one or two personalities I want to refer to because of the, I think this Imperial Defense College is a great thing. But he, just to finish off with this boy, very much later, we were on a trip to the continent. And another Canadian said, let's go out and have something to eat, to this chap. And he said, okay. And when it came time to pay the bill, the Canadian said, I'll pay the bill, you know, with our allowances and so forth. And British pay in those days was still as atrocious as it, the reputation was correct. And there was a bit of an argument started, and finally Max said, no, I'll pay the bill. And this chap said, no. And they both had a few drinks. And so finally this British chap said, this Englishman, he said, Max, he said, I could buy you out 1,000 times over. I am an extremely wealthy man. I will pay the bill. And that was near the end of the course, and it was the first indication that anyone had had in a year that this man was not the usual university graduate, Oxford civil servant who was terribly clever, but also he was an extremely wealthy man. Never showed it, never, in any way. Anyway, came to the college by train, had come by a car, not now, but was in itself extremely well known. And that's the type of person he was. He was just an absolute delight. And he, all the way, he became a very popular person on the course, as you can imagine. In every syndicate, he had a fine brain, so everybody listened, and he made great contributions to them. Mm-hmm. Well, one of my personalities, and I might as well disclose of a couple of others. There was another chap, one of the Indians who was on the course, was the opposite in terms of work. He felt that the Imperial Defense College was beneath him, only as an Indian could do, with great disdain. And he would attend only those lectures which he felt he might get some benefit from. And he would, he only attended syndicates, and there were about half a dozen during the year, but he would only attend those if he felt he would be allowed to make a real contribution to the, he was that kind of superiority complex.
What did you?
Pardon? He was an external man from.
You don't remember his name?
No, I don't remember. Well, I have his name at home, but I don't remember it here right at the moment.
Yeah.
Well, the very last course, the very last syndicate. Again, I was a syndicate leader for the very last one. This is the business of building up. What are we going to? What should the defense policies for Great Britain and the Commonwealth be? And he was on my syndicate. Well, I got several of the types together, and I said, let's get this character. Now, if he does come to in one of our syndicate meetings, let's set the stage whereby we'll get immediately on to bombing policy. What is the strategic bombing policy going to be? And we'll rig it this way, that we're going to attack Moscow without any hesitation. The first thing to do is bomb the living Jesus out of Moscow. Well, the reason why we said that was that he had let it be known, about October, that he was ambassador designate to Moscow for India. And we said there'll be no warning, blow the living the place right off the map. Well, he just jumped out of his chair and he said, you can't do that. He bet. In other words, he said, what about all the diplomats? And we all said, sorry, I'm afraid they're going to get bombed off the face of it. They're all going to be killed. And he said, you can't do that. So that was the only way we got back at him in a whole year for this very superior, supercilious attitude that this man had. Needless to say, he was probably the most unpopular person on the go because he really did make little or no contribution. Then there were others. We had a Pakistan, the Air Force Pakistani. Was a boy, I do remember his name, Asghar Khan. He was a big man, very quiet, but a fine, fine man. He went on, became chief of the Pakistani Air Force, and then the president of Pakistan Airlines, and then got into politics, and was running against another Khan, and damn near beat him for the presidency of the of the country. I went to see him, again, a little later this will come up, but I want to make reference to it here, the value of IDC. One of the UN operations, we were in trouble up in Kashmir. And he, at that time, Asghar was chief of the Pakistani Air Force. And I went to him, And I phoned and made arrangements to see him. I wanted to make sure he was going to be in, and he was. And as soon as I walked in, he said, "I know what you need." And he said, "I've already taken care of it." And before I'd even opened my mouth. And that was all because of an IDC connection. And it was right. He had. I then said, "Are you sure?" And he said, I had a report from my wing commander, the base commander, that you had been to see him, and I know now what the problem is. He said, "I've arranged it. It's all taken care of." So without me having to ask for it, it was just great. And only because of that IDC connection. And there was another case, too, which perhaps a little later I might come to, where with an American, where a terribly difficult situation. I was able to go to Washington, go straight to this man, because he happened to be in the job, and we sat down, and within 5 minutes, we had a solution to the problem.
This American chap, had he been on IDC?
He was on IDC, yes. The Americans went to IDC, yes. They had an Air Force man, an Army man, and a Marine man, and a State Department man. The Americans had four people at IDC. And it was good value, great value, because they were able to throw out stuff from a U.S. point of view, and they were all very, very carefully handpicked. The Americans really were. Their state man, he was a bit of a mind, but nonetheless he was damn clever, and he knew state policy. Yeah. So he was able to throw out a lot of stuff that was good. And again, from a security point of view, there was it was a closed shop, and it was recognized, and people could talk without fear of being referred to or repeated.
Who were the other Canadians with you, Reg?
Well, one was Hal McLern, who was in the Judge Advocate's shop, a group captain, and he was selected, and he was the first person outside of what you might call the operational field to be selected, because he was a judge, a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I think he was given it because Harold has done an awful lot of hard work, was very highly thought of, and really needed a break. He needed to get away. He was almost on his uppers from overwork.
Yeah.
And I think they gave it to him as a rest. And we'd get right away from Ottawa and the shop, and then because he went right back into it afterwards. The Army man was Harold Wrench, Arthur Wrench. Now there was a case, just a few years later, Harold retired, age, and is, I think, still, he went to be head of the Red Cross in Toronto, and I think is still the national director of the Red Cross. He may have retired just in the last year or two, but he was, anytime there was a great, some dreadful event, some in the world, and the Canadian Red Cross were taking action, it would be in the paper that General Wrench, the president or whatever, chairman or whatever he was of the Canadian Red Cross, has made the following statement, and he would then say what Canada was doing. The Navy man was a boy by the name of Plummer, which I didn't know him. He was a funny type, and he got into, I must be careful here. As I remember, he wrote something about two or three years later after IDC, which was highly critical of government policy, and resigned and left the service. That was it. And who else did we have? That's Army, Navy, Air Force, and there was somebody from... No, I think we had... What the hell was the other one? Was it a police from RCMP? No, I can't remember. I'll have to look at the picture to refresh my memory. It's gone for the minute. No, that's right. No, we didn't have anybody. At that time, external affairs were expanding. Yeah. And we were opening up embassies. And that year, external affairs said, we simply cannot spare a senior civil servant to go to IDC. So we'll have to beg off sending somebody that year. So there were only three Canadians on the course, where there normally would have been four. Then one other personalities was the South African Air Force man, a boy by the name of Heemstra. And he later went on to become chief of the South African Air Force and became, a chairman of the Joint Chiefs organization? Yes, he went on and became chairman of the Joint Chiefs as well.
Yeah.
But Heemstra was, again, very quiet, very pleasant chap, until one day when the Archbishop of Canterbury came to deliver a lecture. And I still can't remember how it happened, because the dear old Archbishop was fairly dry. And then all of a sudden he got on to apartheid, and how he got there, I don't know, but he went on for 5 or 10 minutes. And finally, everyone was sort of glancing at Heemstra, and he was just getting redder and redder in the face, until finally he just jumped up on his feet, and he said, "Your Grace, I'm sorry, but I must interrupt. Because what you have been saying about apartheid shows an abysmal ignorance of the whole problem." the commandant. He sat back. And then Heemstra said, "Your Grace, have you ever been to South Africa?" And of course, the Archbishop said, "No, I'm afraid I haven't." So with that, Heemstra gave the Archbishop a 10-minute lecture on apartheid and the problem that South Africa has. Well, God, everybody, of course, just enjoyed it. Whether they didn't make any difference whether they agreed with Heemstra or not. But the fact that Heemstra, who was a very quiet person, finally, when it was over, the Archbishop, he apologized. He said, you can see he was a general. Heemstra introduced himself, should I say. So he said, I'm Brigadier Heemstra, I'm from South Africa. The Archbishop apologized and said, it's quite obvious that I am ill-prepared on this subject, and I must do some more studying on this matter. And that then gracefully just went on with the rest of his talk. So that was quite a high point in the college, and I suppose that was the value of having these various people there. It as soon as you started to get taught, as we did, and of course discussing the world, and you got into certain areas where you had people who had first-hand knowledge of what was going on. They contributed an enormous amount, and that was the way you learned. And it was either done in a lecture in the question period after a lecture, or of course in the syndicate.
Yeah.
And they had an excellent library. And you were required to read about one book and preferably two books a week. Now, that was pretty heavy sledding, and the only ones who even came close to it were the Australians, because the Australians were not permitted to bring their families. And so they literally had a year in London.
Yeah.
And again, the Australians were all of an older group, and they weren't chasing skirts or like that in London. And as a result, they had a lot of time. So they did do, and you had to sign for the books. They had a ledger in the library, and you signed the books you took out. And I suppose there were some who probably just took them out and never read the damn things, but that was, of course, just defeating the whole purpose. They really wanted you to read as much as you possibly could. It was encouraging. Well, the day... Now, I should talk about the day, because it really was a gentleman's course. The first lecture was at 10 o'clock in the morning. On Mondays, it was 10:15, because people had to have an extra 15 minutes to get over the weekend that they'd been on.
Beautiful.
And there was one lecture, and that was in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then the afternoons were free for either syndicate work or reading,
mm-hmm.
if you wished. Then, it spread right throughout the course, were many side trips throughout England. To visit various industrial plants, military installations, then trips to the continent, to Germany particularly. Then, of course, in the summer, the big trip. And there was, in the month of August, was devoted to a major trip.
Mm-hmm.
And the IDC went to several ways. There was a North American trip, there was an African trip, and then there was a Middle East trip. And I was put on the Middle East trip. And, of course, in 1955, the Middle East was just simply fascinating.
So this would be the class.
Yes, it was an element. That's right. Yes. The class splitting three ways to go to these different ways. They have since changed that. I think they go pretty well around the world now. I think they've added another tour. But in those days, we were restricted. I say, money was still a problem. Because, as I say, this was an expensive course. And that was one of the big expenses, was the cost of that tour. And I'll come to that in a minute. But the traveling, again, was all part of, and well designed, it was all tied in with what you were doing at that particular moment, and whether it was economy or whether it was politics or whatever it might be. And then that big summer trip was just before the big final exercise, which, as I say, was a three-month paper. And they then worked the syndicate to make sure that people from all of the three trips were on each syndicate, well represented, so that there were people who had been to these various parts and who could contribute in the final paper. The people on the course were absolutely magnificent. Just a wonderful group, with the odd exception. And, of course, the social life became very heavy indeed, because everybody, whether for protocol reasons or just sheer friendship, had to have dinner parties and cocktail parties. And, of course, the college had its own social things, social functions, such as when the Derby was on, to have a great big double-decker bus with the open top on it, we left London at 7:30 and drove down to Ascot and went in on the inner track, and we had all the booze and a prepared lunch done by the kitchen and so forth, all done up including the champagne, the whole nine yards. the only comment that was made on that trip was that most of the Commonwealth people went. There was a limited number of seats, and of course wives went as well, a limited number of seats, and so a lot of the Brits, nearly all of the Commonwealth and the Americans went on, I think pretty well, 100%. And then the British filled up whatever seats were left on this bus, and then had room for the staff to look after the bar and what have you. Of course, the comment was made by the commandant. He said, I don't know what happened on that Ascot. He didn't go. I don't know what happened yesterday, but he said, I have had reports that the bar was dry by the time the bus reached Ascot at 9:30 in the morning. And it's true. It was true. We had to go into the very pub tents all around the inner circle to get a drink. Anyway, but that was the sort of, it was a gentleman's course.
Yeah.
But there were also some great moments, fun-wise, in a social sense. Yeah. And probably the peak of that was the Queen and Philip were coming to the college, and it was the first time that anyone, royalty, had come to spend a morning. And the idea was to come and sit in on one of the exercises and listen to each syndicate present its solution, if you will, to that particular subject.